gates for people to pass through, while the huge outer fortress door remains locked. On only her second effort, she picks up the fine scissors and cuts out a shape for the light to appear from the next sheet of paper. The sun burns through above the small door, and the writing above is cross-hatched and illegible. What does it mean? It means color, interaction of shapes, a ring of crimson around the sun, a shaft of letters, another shaft of letters, rays of writing in a private language whose meaning she might receive in dreams. The key to a desk, the iron key to the villa, a horsehead knocker from her house in North Carolina. She's knocking there, knocking and knocking, and wondering why she does not answer her own door. Yes, altered state. Rowan arrives late in the afternoon. They're all gathering before the party to exchange gifts, since both he and Susan will take off tomorrow. May I show you something? Actually, it's your present. I hope you like it. He follows Camille into the studio, where the lamp on the worktop shines down on number one and the scattered materials for number two. You were with me when I discovered paper. Then we had that day in Bologna looking at artists' books and more paper. You told me where to go in Venice. I can't thank you enough. Rowan slips his arm around her waist and leans over the paper door. He's quiet for too long. What if he's trying desperately to think of some tactful, encouraging words to cover his embarrassment for her? But she looks sideways at him and sees the sweet tinge of a smile. How he looked when he was too pleased to speak. She's seen that look three times, now four. He shakes his head slowly and pulls her close. Brilliant. Brilliant. Let me say, I recognized you. He lets her go and lifts the paper door, his arms outstretched. Camille, trust me, this is a one-off. There's nothing like it. You've got to go with this all the way. You've nailed it. My Christmas gift. Ah, this is due for better walls than my yellowed office. Right now, let's hang it over your worktop to inspire you. This is where you began the great work of your next decade. Honey, you've got it in spades.
Wait, are you sure?
She starts laughing and stops. Rowan examines the new one she started this afternoon. These have a quality of mystery, but they're also direct, strong. It's like your dreaming mind is throwing out images for you to catch. That's close to what I'm after, but some of this comes just from snatches of every day, phrases that seemed to require being written backward. And the bird, see his feet? The letters N-M, that's the nun I told you about. The mosaic, the shawl in the fresco. Things the day tosses out for me to catch. Just stay open. You are. That's how the North Carolina clay formed you.
What?
Oh, you know, the creation myth that the gods slapped us into shape from local clay.
True enough.
Camille feels alarmed by his extravagant appreciation.
Don't go back. I need you here to cheer me on.
You will be fine. More than fine. And I'll be back with the swallows.
So long from now. Will we forget each other?
The last thing I expected was to find a boyfriend on this trip. Okay, girlfriend. Give me some credit. We'll stay in touch. I write actual letters. I'll be back in late May.
By candlelight.
Everyone brings gifts to the living room, where Susan has started a sputtering fire. Julia lights candles on both windowsills. "I've brought a special wine," Rowan announces. "It's a 2001 Amarone. Chris would be proud. Let's find the big-ass glasses." Cleve winces at that. From his satchel, Rowan takes out his gifts, carefully wrapped in brown paper, tied with string and sprigs of rosemary. "Just pensieri," he says, "little thoughts."
"Ever the fine press publisher," Camille said. "Lucky I have another something for you, since my first gift was rejected."
She hands him a red box. He holds up a burly heather green V-neck sweater. "For the coldest day in Berkeley," he says. Everyone toasts, unties ribbons, and exclaims. Julia has never seen a bone press, but appears to be delighted. She passes a plate of walnut and gorgonzola crostini. "Just to buy it, because Kit is throwing a huge dinner. I know the menu." At Matilda's bottega, Rowan designed and made blank books, perfect travel journals, he has brought for them. He used ochre handmade paper covers, each stamped with a vintage design of sailboat, bicycle, or biplane. Julia gives him a bag of her lemon biscotti for the flight back to California tomorrow. Susan has two small pillows stuffed with herbs for him. "They help you sleep," she explains. Everything's unwrapped and exclaimed over. The glasses of inky Amarone catch firelight. The little tree shines with a bit of bravura. The crostini disappear. Cleve exclaims over gloves and socks, just what he needs.
"Truly," he says, "it's a comfort to have just the right gloves and socks."
He sits down at the piano, which has yet to be touched. Oddly, he plays Summertime, the three almost dead keys plunking. They gather around him and belt it out, the Southern women all remembering the Janis Joplin version, the Ella version, and Rowan, whose cultural memory would be more the Beach Boys' California Girls, can only watch. Cleve pauses to take out three small boxes from his jacket pocket.
"You girls, excuse the girls, but you are to me. I don't want you to forget where you came from. I had a feeling that might be easy from what Julia reports."
In the boxes, each finds a thin silver chain with a white enameled Magnolia grandiflora pendant. Still sensitive to the jewelry heist, Camille holds hers in the palm of her hand as the others immediately clasp theirs around their necks.
"Very pretty, Daddy. Someone in Savannah made them?" "Yes, that daughter of Allison. She's teaching at the art college now."
Allison, Julia's plump and lucky next-door neighbor. Julia feels a pang of anguish that Cheryl, a good 10 years younger than Lizzie, is designing delicate jewelry while Lizzie falters. But no, she looks hard at the meticulous design, the waxy petals outlined in gold filament.
"Oh, brava for Cheryl. Here, Camille, let me fasten it for you."
"You are too sweet," Susan says. "This is so nostalgic. I have a giant magnolia in my front yard at home." What a mess they make, she thought, with their leathery leaves falling constantly. But oh, those few weeks of bloom when the scent blows through raised windows into the house at night, and you know it's the breath of the South. You breathe in that fragrance and think, why live anywhere else, ever? She walks over to the window and stares out at small lights down the hills in the distance. Everyone's at home. Everyone gathering. Not Aaron. Not barreling in with arms full of polka-dot-wrapped gifts.
At Christmas, his red silk bow tie, outrageous. His square, college fullback shoulders, how big and right he stands, building a fire. When the girls were little and excited. Now they're soon boarding planes that will take them 40,000 feet in the air over the ocean to meet her in a foreign country, where there are no family julep cups on the table, no carolers from the Methodist Church, no annual open house, the cinnamon and clove scent of mulled wine with toasted pecans and cheese straws on the coffee table, the fragrant longleaf pine that touched the ceiling, had to touch the ceiling, the obscene piles of gifts, and the windows fogged. She regroups and turns back to the different life, Cleve now thumping out, "Angels we have heard on high." Camille calls everyone into the kitchen. On the table sits a fancy new food processor. Advance gift from Charlie. He couldn't replace the jewelry, but he could order this for us. Friends. They scale the hill, turn at the top of their driveway, and then suddenly they see Fonte, lighted candles flickering in every window. "This is your life, Susan Ware," Julia whispers. She holds her daddy's arm. Camille and Rowan bring up the rear. "Will you go back to my place after dinner?" he asks. "I've stashed another bottle of that Amarone. We need to celebrate Paper Doors number one. Celebrate in the best way possible." "Sweep me off my feet," Camille says. "Yes, I would love to spend a cozy night with you." "No, not a cozy night, but a scandalous night. I don't want to think, but it's the last for a long time." "Ha, too bad we're too old to cause scandals." Camille feels sad and excited. Tomorrow, Rowan will be back in Berkeley for Christmas with his older sister and his ancient mother, while she will be delirious with excitement over seeing Charlie and Ingrid. "I know you hate leaving, but are you also glad to go home?" "I'll have a whole day to recover myself," she thinks, "erase all traces and put on my mother face. Yes, I adore my mother. My sister and I share the care. It's not a burden." Camille remembers her own mother saying, "Any man who doesn't like his mother has got to be damaged." Charles loved his mother. She knows Charlie does. "What a good friend I've found," she thinks. "But you don't have sex with a friend, at least not in my realm. So what is he to me?" "Lover," she laughs out loud. "What's funny?" he asks. "Life in general." They step up the pace. It's beginning to sleet. Can anything look more welcoming and warm than a rustic stone house in the country all lit for Christmas? I've bought out the entire candle supply in San Rocco. In the whole house, even the bathrooms, no electric lights are on, except in the kitchen. Stefano has let two of his kitchen staff help me tonight. My Christmas gift to you. Colin and I are not constantly getting up to clear plates. The table is set, snowy white cloth with huge linen napkins I've collected from the antique market, all with various monograms of long-lost women who set their tables for guests. My place cards I've pierced with twigs of holly, the only touch of red. Enough people are bilingual that I'm assured no dead conversation zones bog down the table dynamic. White roses. Thank you, Susan. White hydrangeas, out of season, everywhere, giving their own light to the rooms. The closet-sized flower shop in town overflows with blooms someone trucks down from Holland greenhouses. No wreaths or sprays, only cut flowers. Why? Because most are meant for the cemetery, which is heavily adorned for the entire holiday. Thanks to the dead, we have such abundance. Everyone arrives. Buona sera. Hello. Ciao. Hello. They bear gifts and wine. Lovely to kiss cold cheeks. I especially wanted the Americans, Wally and Deborah, to meet the three women. They retired here from Chicago and have thrown themselves into practicing stone wall building and helping, financially and hands-on, with Scuola Materna, elementary school, cultural trips. Those who really learn to live here. Deborah writes a bilingual newsletter that we all look at to find out what's going on. Ah, the Villa Assunta contingent. Rowan's last night. Tomorrow he returns to Berkeley for his last semester of teaching book arts at Mills College. I give them all big hugs. All good sabbaticals must come to an end, amico, I whisper. He hands me three of his publications, treasures. Susan looks terrific in a red velvet fitted jacket with a white satin shell. And this must be Cleve Hadley. What a southern name. I already feel protective toward him, sensing how he must have suffered with Julia over the slacker granddaughter. Our good friends Guido, oh, devastatingly good-looking, in the manner your mother would advise you against, and Amalia, Nicola and Brian, Stefano, and then witty Canadian expat Belinda and her German diplomat, retired husband Carl, also stamp in, shaking off rain and sleet. How to make it rain? Plan a party. Carl has scraped his fender on a stone wall when parking, and steam seems to emanate from his ears. I hand him a to-the-top glass of Prosecco. Belinda is wearing what looks like a Scottish kilt. Unfortunate, my mother would say, and I see her eye my outlandish garb skeptically. I catch myself in the mirror and quite like this surprise version of me. Everyone heads toward the fire. Colin has created quite a blaze and seems proud of it, or of something. He is beautiful, my man. Lucky he is. Colin looks, how to say it, he looks kind. You see his fringy long lashes. Didn't Elizabeth Taylor have a double row? How his gaze lingers as his lips form an archaic upturn. You know he's there, all present and accounted for. He doesn't appear, as many men do, to hold back, reserve judgment. His vibe is, you're just fine, my honey. During dessert, he's going to announce our late little straggler. I didn't want to say anything early on because I thought the conversation would be baby, baby all night. I touch my middle to feel the slight, hard mounding, as when at the beach, as a child, I covered my feet with wet sand. Stefano's waiters pass my antipasti platters, various salumi crostini of chicken livers, crostini neri, the one item no Tuscan party exists without, crostini of peas and mascarpone, bowls of baked spicy olives, prosciutto wrapped around breadsticks, cheeses, endive leaves stuffed with farro salad, mushroom pastries, and fried vegetable slivers. For dinner, I have scattered the three women among the guests so everyone meets new friends. For my right side, I've claimed the charming father of Julia, an old-school gentleman. He is wearing a paisley ascot, a camel blazer with horn buttons, and his polished wingtips look bespoke. Everything about him is neat and just so. Heartbreaking what that family endures. Fitzy leaps to the mantel. He's snowy white, his plume of tail waving among the flowers. Imperial and impartial. He surveys all with startled citrine eyes. Alare familiaris, a family god crucial to the Roman household. He does blink at me, the one who feeds him, looks down at my dress, Margaret's dress, rescued from the suitcase, hung in the sun to air. When I tried it on, Colin insisted that I wear it.
You look exotic, like the favorite in a Turkish harem, he claimed.
Gold silk with drooping sleeves. Watch out for sauces at the table. A sash of amethyst brocade and a wide swath of ruched crimson velvet hem trailing the floor. She was even taller. I feel glamorous, like a woman in a D.H. Lawrence novel, or a Bloomsbury literata looking forward to a louche weekend in the country. I hope I don't look like I'm wearing a thrift store bathrobe. Everyone here? No, not Ricardo. Late train? Luca and Gilda are coming, though it's hard for them to escape their hotel, and they usually dash in just as we sit down. We'll wait. What's the hurry? Many of the people I love most in San Rocco gather at our table. Julia, Camille, and Susan, only here for a season, have so naturally become a part of my days that I can't imagine this hillside without them. Since they're older, you'd think I might be responding to their maternal auras, but mothers all, they don't seem to have them. Or perhaps they've shed them. Still, I feel a benevolence will fall on my baby by their presence. If I'm weepy and exhausted with a newborn, I'll find solace at their kitchen table. I know I could call in the night that we'll sit in the piazza on late summer afternoons drinking lemonade and passing the baby around. Friends, I guess. But because they have had their big losses, they're freed in some way that makes them vulnerable and open. We laugh. We're bonded, too, by sharing this small patch of Tuscany. Guido is on my left. We always flirt. Amalia and Colin don't care at all, knowing us well. Guido is a little younger than I, slim as a skewer, with tar-pot black eyes. His family, settlers in the 12,000s, owns the biggest villa in the province. They're great winemakers, and their castle is the attraction that makes San Rocco prosper more than other small villages. Amalia also comes from those tottering aristocrats who once minted their own money and never knew the extent of their land. Both are late and exquisite flowers on thorny old stalks. You wouldn't think Amalia beautiful unless you know the Leonardo da Vinci painting of Ginevra di Benci. She's a dead ringer for that enigmatic and remote portrait, but Amalia has better hair. Ginevra's mien is somber, but Amalia's face often breaks into an electric smile. Ginevra was said to be a poet. From her whole life, her only remaining lines, I beg your forgiveness. I am a mountain tiger. The bell jangles, and Colin opens the door to Ricardo, Luca, and Gilda, who are given a quick glass of Prosecco and brought to the table. It's 9. It's time for the potato ravioli and the Collio wines Chris gave us. Chin chin, Chris, all alone in California. Come back soon. Not that she ever cooked, but Margaret taught me this lobster pasta. A brief lover chef gave her the recipe. Easy and rich beyond belief. It occurs to me, Margaret is a household god. Leo and Aneta, my Italian family and always hospitable, help pass the platters and fill glasses. Ricardo, man of words and terrific translator of my poems and many others far greater than I, starts the toasts. I seated him beside Susan, garden maven, because he is a rosarian and also because he has a crocus field. He hand-gathers the stamens and dries them, augmenting his meager income with local sales of his saffron. I have a vial for Julia. I'm sure they'll find common topics,
That he is at the Vatican all week provides him with amusing or horrifying anecdotes.
He rises to toast the Pope, whether truly or ironically, we can't tell. He mentions the good future, then ends with some joke about America's current politics, not all of which I get, as I'm overseeing the serving of the stuffed pork roasts, smashed potatoes, and vegetable bundles tied with chives. Cleve, I knew he was one to recognize a situation, rises and thanks all for receiving his daughter and her friends with such warmth. He responds to Ricardo's digs about crazy American politics with a funny reference to Berlusconi's bunga bunga parties, pretending that was what he hoped for tonight. A slight barb from Savannah, but smooth. And then, softly, sweet cane syrup, Tupelo honey, toasting Colin and me, he says he would like to welcome all of us to Savannah, Georgia, whenever we can come. I see Julia's eyebrows fly up at that, but she then stands and in a tremulous voice thanks us in Italian. Brava! She simply says how lucky she and her two friends are to have picked Villa Assunta, as it were, out of a hat. Makes you believe in fate, she concluded. We are so happy to have this fate and to be here tonight. Camille and Susan clamber up and clink glasses all around. To Kit and Colin, our marvelous hosts, Camille adds. Waves of conversation ensue. More politics.
At least we Italians recognize fascists when we see one, says Stefano. Ah, now you do, Susan laughs.
Sally mentions the coming exhibit at the Strozzi Gallery. Brian is talking about immigrants washing up on the southern islands. So many, he claims, that the islands are about to sink.
They want the same things we want, Deborah insists. They should have stayed home and fought for their country, Carl counters.
Gilda announces that she will start a meat carving course at her school. Students will each have a whole pig, learn knife skills, and how to use every part except the squeal. This makes my stomach flip. I raise my water glass to Leo and mouth, grazie, the roasted pork, sublime. I crunch into the crisp and crackling skin. Ricardo quotes an ode by Horace. Yet another reason to love the life here. The whole world is where we live, not a narrow place. When I moved here, I felt as if those blinders that keep horses oriented in one direction were removed. Stefano's men clear the plates and present the wild salad with local goat cheese and yellow beets. Before dessert, Brendan reaches behind him for his guitar and starts in with Per te, a favorite from the Italian singer Jovanotti over in Cortona. From down the table, Colin toasts me. Does anyone notice my glass of blood orange juice? Maybe only Wally, a teetotaler who had issues long ago. Rowan rises and says thanks to the Italians at the table for welcoming yet another stranger. He looks handsome in his craggy bohemian way. Gilda raises her glass in praise of Julia and her cooking talents.
She is more adept than we are. We are jealous of her abilities.
Julia shakes her head no and leans over to give Gilda and Luca a hug. Dessert. I must say, a hush falls as Aneta and I bring out the magnificent roulade. At the same time, Colin scrapes back his chair and turns it over with a loud crack.
Dearly beloved, he begins.
The English speakers laugh and the Italians look at each other with shrugs.
To Kit. You know her as a committed writer. Someone who came here to give her work a new focus, which she did. someone who did not want to follow an expected path. She didn't count on falling in love with someone still flailing around in his career.
He pauses, looking at me.
She has been my lodestar.
We love living among you. We love all of you.
As you know, I'm 40. Kit is 44. Our future is laid out, right? We're free to travel, to work like demons. Free. Well, raise your glasses, please, because we want to toast the interrupted future.
The waiters fill everyone's glasses with fine champagne.
We want to tell you of our unexpected fortune. We're expecting a baby. In June, we will be parents.
Brendan starts a drum roll on the guitar as everyone stands, draining glasses, calling, "Hear, hear!" All astonished, except that I see the knowing smiles of the three women. Everyone rushes to embrace us. The Italians begin singing the victory song of the soccer teams. Amalia crying. The three women nodding, "We knew, we knew." Ricardo, maybe appalled, retreating to the corner to light a cigar. Nicola starting to dance near the fire, joined by Belinda in her ridiculous kilt skirt. Wally and Deborah grab the bottles and keep everyone topped off. In the midst of all, no one forgets the hazelnut roulade. Julia seems astonished. Out come the limoncello, grappa, and Averna bottles, a cheese board and walnuts to crack. A bowl of clementines. We linger long. No need to go. We have the rest of our lives. A magnificent evening for us at Fonte della Foglie. I am a mountain tiger. Part 5. In Touch.
Ciao, Kit.
Stupendous party. Stupendous news. Of course we knew, ever since the dinner in Corman's. Just a quick thank you from here in the Dolomites, where the word cozy must have been invented, but contemporary, not Cuckoo Clock cozy. Our lodge is all soft, sleek, bleached timber, steaming hot tubs, velvety robes, and views into the far yonder. But no snow. My girls are skiing down a piste day made from snow guns. I hope neither breaks a leg. On either side of the run, the hillsides are stubby and brown. No crowds or queues for the lifts. I use them for sightseeing. We can hike through pastures up to a refugio. Oh, potato and apple soup. Venison with truffles. Julia would be blissful. I am sitting out on the broad terrace in the pale sun. We ordered fondue for breakfast. The air feels intoxicating, as though we've lost cabin pressure and a mask-blowing oxygen has descended on us. The apples? Amazing. Ruddy and sweet sour. We've munched the whole basket left in our room.
Ciao from San Casiano. Hope you're enjoying Florida. A presto, Susan.
P.S. I'm CCing this to J and C as I am almost out of battery.
Hey, Susan. Hey, Camille. Y'all were sweet to Daddy. He loved you both. Wasn't Kit and Colin's party fabulous? We found many new friends.
We'd better watch out. We may ensconce ourselves in San Rocco so thoroughly that we'll never leave.
Christmas was strange, but peaceful. We had an afternoon stroll around the Spanish Steps area, Prosecco sitting outside, then dinner, excellent, in our hotel. Afterward, we watched Three Coins in a Fountain, earlier female explorers of Italy. Younger and more romantic.
silly, but I cried. Neither of us mentioned Lizzie or Wade. I'm becoming a master of living in the moment. After grand days in Rome, warm, we came to Naples on the fast train yesterday. A different world. I'll be a long time absorbing the dizzying differences in Italian towns. Atlanta and Charlotte and Raleigh are not profoundly different, right? Well, the quick trip from Rome to Naples lands you in a warp. Racist, I guess, but I've heard that Italians say, after Rome begins Africa. Well, it does seem stupefyingly different. Just from the taxi to the hotel, Daddy and I were gripping each other's hands, and I cried out a couple of times, but the driver just laughed. Finally, I relaxed when I realized that other drivers expected ours to cut and swerve and careen, and that they even expected to drive behind a Vespa with three on it carrying a bicycle horizontally. One smoked, one pulled in the front wheel when necessary, and another manipulated the back wheel, all laughing and calling to friends. No one seemed perturbed but us. Susan, you'd fit in just fine. Today, we wandered along Spaconopoli, the straight street, the Roman Decumanus that splits Naples, up little lanes where it looked like murder could occur, and off it on a cramped little lane where they sell all the paraphernalia, much of it battery-operated so the figures move, for the Presidio setups we saw all over San Rocco. These are incredibly elaborated. Wonder why that craft became quintessential to Naples. Kitschy as hell, of course, but I found myself leaning down and exclaiming over the tiny woman ironing, the man shoving bread into a forno, the vegetable seller, the manger animals shaking their heads, plaster angels. I bought a few. On and on. Daddy thought a little bit went a long way. We proceeded to one of the celebrated pizza places for lunch, and I know it's heretical, but I thought the pizza wasn't that great. Chewy, bready dough and thin tomato and cheese, though the mozzarella is the buffalo milk type. I like the thin Tuscan crust much more. Back at the hotel, before we venture out for the afternoon, a handsome palazzo with a dignified courtyard. Below my window, someone is going through the trash with a stick. Actually, the contrasts get to me in an exciting way. A place where you don't know what to expect. Haven't we become up for that? Let me know how your trips are going. Miss you, Julia. Dear, dear friends, San Rocco seems even more intimate at Christmas. Charlie and Ingrid are falling hard for the place. Ingrid, almost 15 and just out of braces, asked her parents to move here. She's enamored, hearing of a high school called El Liceo, where she would study Latin and Greek. She hasn't excelled at Spanish, however. She's loving the pudding thick hot chocolate and the melt-in-the-mouth cream-filled meringues. Most of all, she loves the villa. I think it conjures the secret garden. Charlie and Lara, too, are stunned by every room, and also by the way of life. Even Lara, who always finds fault, as my mother would say, is silenced. She walks from room to room, kind of nodding her head and smiling. This is good. Of course, she does take exception to the cats and keeps shooing them off the furniture. What were you thinking, keeping three cats? She asked incredulously. We weren't thinking, I answered sweetly. The four of us grilled one of those giant local steaks and cooked potatoes in the fireplace. We had a big salad of wild greens that Patrizia dropped off. Aneta brought a blackberry crostata.
Julia, we did well.
Tomorrow night, we're invited by Gilda and Luca to a feast at the hotel. My family will be awed and thrilled. I am having great fun seeing our town through their eyes. Charlie, dreamboat boy, is attuned to everything he's seeing. Lara wants to rest, as she travels all the time, but she is making an effort. Susan, thanks again for finding us the apartment in Venice. I can't wait to see their faces when we arrive. Charlie researched all the art. He may swoop to heaven in a cloud, like the Virgin. He's reserved a table for us for New Year's Eve, right on the Grand Canal, hoping for snow. Want me to visit your antique shop, Susan? Can't wait to be there. I have a soul connection to that mirage on the waters. After they fly out of Venice, I'm giving myself a day alone. It will be sad to see them go, but as you know, that city speaks to me. And I am looking forward to taking up where we left off at Villa Assunta. Travel well. Have many epiphanies before Epiphany when we again raise our glasses together. XXXOOO, Camille. Crossing the bridge. Ride by. Look at the neighborhood. Chris wouldn't recognize Lizzie if he saw her naked in the street. He needed to drive down to San Francisco to have the design of his vineyard labels adjusted. Now that his son Carter is finishing his master's at Davis, Chris wants to add his name on Magnitude Vineyard's back label. Carter will be an astute winemaker. His palate is discerning, especially during periodic barrel sampling when you have to know, while the wine is evolving, what the wine will be. A fourth-generation winemaker, Carter is wed to the sere California hills and can't wait to come home and start updating. He says it nicely, innovating around what already works. Chris gets the message. Move over, Dad. Fine with him. The girlfriend, also graduating in enology, will come too. Waka, delicate, slender as a soda straw, Japanese-American. Her grandparents, born in Sacramento, were rounded up and put in a camp to wait out World War II. Her hair hangs straight down to her waist, and she's always fiddling with it, tossing her head, swooping it up in her hands and letting it fall, often while delivering a confident opinion. Could be useful. Could be irritating. Carter wants her there. And Chris has a philosophy about allowing his boy what he wants, whenever it seems reasonable. He's sure that's why Carter grew into a generous man. In late February, the green Marin Hills glow. As Chris speeds down 101 slightly faster than the flow, traffic moves smoothly. Emerging from the tunnel, he bursts onto the full view of the white city floating on choppy cobalt waters, the bridges like glimmering erector sets, and pristine triangles of sails cutting toward Alcatraz. Chris fell hard when he first moved here, and even now he feels a billowing excitement. What's happening on the West Coast now sends out ripples that the rest of the country feels a decade later. He knows that. He turns into the Marina neighborhood, imagining living in one of the Spanish colonial houses from the 30s, a small courtyard where Julia is setting the table for friends. He finds himself humming, then stops. Do I always have to think City by the Bay, Tony Bennett crooning at the Fairmont? A bit embarrassing. His throat tightening with emotion any time "I Left My Heart" starts up.
Oh, Dad, cornball, Carter would say.
September, the pretty girl, Lauren, leaning on her elbows at the bar, high on a hill,
First job, the end of his summers in the unlovely, dusty fields of his parents' farm in Modesto, crops and heartbreak and a prevailing feeling of exile, the shock of arrival in the chilly city, halfway to the stars. He swerves right as a motorcyclist almost clips his front fender. San Francisco, like no other, even Rome. Even now, rife with techies. At least they buy wine when they're not drinking livid green juices or sourcing those leafy greens. A few weeks in San Fran, and he'd known that his desire to escape all through his teens was right. He grew up an exile from this sharp air and the undulating hills with heart-stopping views, where everyone is young and rapacious for what's to come. The last edge, razor edge, of the country. He loves it. Loves the grandest ocean, the cold, cold waves along Point Reyes's sweeping beaches, invigorating foggy walks. California is overpopulated, but the land itself remains primitive and lonely. Opposite of his more intimate love, Italy, with its humanly shaped landscapes and towns. What luck to have both places, like Julia and friends, falling hard for a way of life so diverse from their southern heritage. Julia, what if they'd met 20 years ago? The children they could have had, the trips, the building of Magnitude Vineyards, her publishing books, the bi-country life. But instead, he has Carter. He can only be happy for that. Speeding toward the city, he's elated. Not here, that's over. A plane must soar over the pole and land in an ancient, mellow place bordered by a bluer sea. Below Lower Pacific Heights, the ambiance gets pretty low. Although now it's dotted with spiffy cafes, he's looking for the last known address of one Lizzie Hadley. No, she'd probably have the husband's last name, the jerk, Tyler, Wade Tyler it is. He tries to think of what Julia said about Lizzie, other than the chronicle of her downward spiral, her crash and burn. Does not suffer fools gladly. Used to have a pet turtle named George. Collected shells. No clue what she looks like. Wait, Julia mentioned her small teeth when they saw a barista smile in Friuli. Lizzie has teeth like that. Little pearls. Not much to go on. Doubt if she smiles much, especially if she has a meth smile. A row of dingy Victorians, three of them fixed up by optimistic remodelers. A few spindly trees surrounded by dog shit. Other houses, at least painted, with pots of agave or grasses on the porch and Roman shades on the windows. Down and out in San Francisco is not quite as down and out as in other cities. Real estate is too valuable for landlords to let property go too far into shambles. He can tell at a glance this neighborhood is gentrifying. Crackheads soon to amble on to the last fringes. He slows at her intersection. Second house in, worst house on the block, purple and peeling, looks like a possible drug habitat. Julia mentioned purple, and not all the way derelict. A lank-haired woman smokes on the steps, and a skinny guy leans against the railing, checking his phone. Chris parks farther down the street and walks back to the corner store, catty-cornered from the house. Another lavender Queen Anne Victorian looks possible, but an ancient black woman exits and begins sweeping her porch. Next door to her, painters in hazmat under tarps are scraping off decades of lead paint. Another house about to flip. He buys a bag of chips, mints, and a bottle of water.
The Pakistani owner hardly looks away from his computer as he rings up the purchase.
You know of any houses for rent around here? Or any for sale?
Chris asks.
Everything for sale, is the clipped reply.
He squints at his screen. He's wearing a limp t-shirt printed with a skeleton image.
Good for investment, I'm sure.
You know what these suckers sell for now? Fix it up, triple your money.
What about that purple three-story?
Nah, that's sort of a halfway place.
Halfway to what? I'd like to know.
Bingo.
They're recovering?
Seems like some of them are.
Not for sale or rent, then. Owned by the city. They all get paid. Nice work. I guess I've heard about that.
He gestured to the woman smoking on the steps.
They come in here to shop, I guess.
That one does. The guy lifts himself a free beer now and then.
I just let it go, poor sucker. He can't even talk, just stutters.
He blows through his lips and flips them with his finger, blubbering.
The house next door. Someone's gussied it up, all right.
He didn't want to appear too inquiring.
Paid 300,000. Put that much into it. Now it's worth over 1,000,000.
All that, and you get to live next to a halfway house.
You got it. And you get your car window smashed.
How many live there?
There were 8. I haven't seen 2 of them in months. A guy tattooed, even around his eyes. And a southern girl. All hoity-toity. But when I got mugged last year, she heard the glass breaking, came running over and got me an ambulance and stayed with the shop until my brother-in-law got here.
Oh, man. Mugged? He turns his profile, showing his bent nose and a rippled scar running up his cheek and back into his hair.
Baseball bat. They got a whopping $72. Me, I got a month of hell.
Very bad. Sorry to hear that.
He decides to come clean.
Hey, I'm actually looking for a southern woman, about 35. Her family hasn't heard from her in a while. This is confidential, but I'm wondering if this woman who came to your rescue might be the one. How many southern belles are there in halfway houses? This cross street is her last known address.
The Pakistani looks wary.
I couldn't say. Go across the street and ask those losers.
Oh, that's okay. Probably a mistake anyway. Thanks, man.
Ah, well.
What the fuck?
The woman is called Liz.
Is that the name you're looking for?
She's long gone. Ambulance took her away. She's probably overdosed.
Chris drives on to the super cool graphic design studio on a leafy section of Pacific Avenue and orders the slight redesign of his label. The front image, a simple pen and ink of a vine at bud break, remains, but he's revised the back. The young woman working with him wears a flared black skirt in stiff panels and a white blouse with winged sleeves, comme des garçons, or maybe something even more hip, black ankle boots, her hair, structured to the max, falling like a raven wing across half her face. Chris flashes on the woman smoking on the steps at Lizzie's halfway house, her mouse-colored hair in ropey strands, eyes lost in space, her legs askew so that if anyone wanted to, he could see her crotch. Chris didn't want to, hell no. But her doleful look, glazed, sad, barely registering him as he passed, sends a frisson of sympathy through him for her. For Lizzie's lost potential, for Julia's sorrow, even for the ass Wade, what he'd endured with the two women he loved.
Cara Julia, he writes. I tried to call but got the unavailable message. I know you said no to me looking for Lizzie. I overrode that because you hesitated, and I'm sure you want news. I didn't plan to encounter her just to see if she's still there. I did go to the intersection. The mom-and-pop owner knew her. He said that she isn't there anymore. An ambulance took her away.
He told her about the mugging and Lizzie getting the man to the hospital and continues,
There are others at the house who might know where she is. Do you want me to go back and ask? This sounds seriously bad.
He went on, writing about his day, pausing to pour a stony white from his neighbor down the road to slice into the roast chicken he picked up at Whole Foods.
Wondering what you are up to, where you are. Sometime I want to show you San Francisco.
Un abbraccio forte.
A strong hug. Now, wondering tonight, where is that Lizzie?
Almonds, the first flower. In late winter, a blissful day arrives. Soft air descends, mild enough to open a window. Margaret always maintained that pressure systems become blocked at Gibraltar, allowing the warm Mediterranean on our side to work its magic. True or not, I always imagine massive storms held back by a big rock. The almond tree just outside my study blooms, albeit tentatively, the unostentatious flowers sending out a faint scent. Not of almonds, but of the white paste one of my friends used to eat in kindergarten. Such a mild winter that I never uprooted the white geraniums in pots along the stone wall. Now I'll only have to trim the dead away, and they'll reboot for summer. What winter there was, we missed while in sunny Florida. We came back here to days of long walks up the mountains, our boots slushing through damp leaves, to a skittish pair of caprioli leaping among our olive trees, and to the grunts of wild boars searching for acorns in the night. All our friends were ready to serve forth ribollita and sausages and beef stews, especially Julia, who completed a study of Tuscan pork with Gilda over the winter. They sliced and parsed local pigs, especially the boars that are hunted assiduously, but still manage to double their population every couple of years. Margaret said she wanted to write, Wild Boars, B-O-R-E-S, I have known. Julia is making her own fennel-flavored sausages and grilling the big liver, which I've managed to avoid. Her first fricassee tasted gamey, but after she got the soaking in vinegar part down, her daubes have been succulent and fall off the bone tender. With Colin away in London, I have the day, and I need it. Since we returned, I still haven't completely unpacked. The work I did there lies on my desk, a stack of notes and one folder with 6 poems. Margaret's manuscript, too, is part of the pile. Her work and mine, now hopelessly entwined. Instead of diving into that wreck, I step outside to clip almond branches and stand them in a jar on the kitchen counter. Spring. Coming. At 5 months, I have a lunar curve. The little moonwalker baby steps around once or twice a day. Late at night, I feel her. Weightless, somersaulting, or him undocked and floating in the mothership. We elected not to be told the sex. I don't know why, except that it gives us more room to imagine the mystery of this mystery being. Never since playing with dolls have I thought of myself as a mother. I aligned with the many women writers who never had children
and who knew that motherhood strikes the death knell for creativity.
Knell. Old English, knillane. Old Norse, knula. To beat. To strike.